The following program is brought to you by Podcast One Sportsnet.
The Steve Austin Show Unleashed is sponsored in part this week by TrueCar. When you're ready to buy a new or used car, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
He started in a small town in Texas. Worked his ass off to become one of the most famous wrestlers of all time.
We're going to take care of business tonight, and that's the bottom line.
And now, he's dominating the world of on-demand audio.
And he's doing it for the working man.
This is a damn good outlet for me to spew the bullshit off my brain.
Yeah!
This is Steve Austin Unleashed. Unleashed.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Steve Austin Show. I am coming to you from the state of Nevada. Still out here visiting the in-laws and enjoying the wide open spaces of the great state of Nevada. Hey, man, this is the first Unleashed Show after Christmas. I hope everybody had a damn good Christmas. We had a good time being out here. I miss going down there to South Texas. I miss seeing my mother and my father and the rest of my family. But I tell you what, man, after driving down there 1,500 miles back from Thanksgiving and just do a quick turnaround and drive all the way back. It was just too much and just couldn't fly the dogs on a commercial airplane. I just won't do that. I don't know what would happen to them. And if something happened to my dogs, I don't know what I'd do. So we ended up coming over here to Nevada. It's about a 475-mile journey versus that 1,500-mile journey to Texas. Spent Christmas with my brother-in-law and my two nieces and had a real good time. I miss my family down there, but I hope all you guys had a good Christmas. We really did over here. It was just good to hang out with one another. We didn't exchange gifts. Hell, I didn't get my wife anything for Christmas. My wife didn't get me anything for Christmas. We kind of normally just give something small to each other, but I enjoy the tradition of Christmas. I love the holiday season. It's always a chance for us to see our family and some of our friends, and this time we got to see Kristen's side of the family, and that's what Christmas is for us. Ain't about giving nothing. I did get myself a four-wheeler. I told you guys I was going to treat myself to a birthday present / Christmas present. I got a Kawasaki Brute Force 750, and I got it in the Realtree camo pattern. And I've been riding that thing around, and that thing is absolutely badass. Just tons of torque, tons of speed, great balance. Just, man, everything in the four-wheeler that you need, it's got. Haven't taken any rough terrain yet, but just scatting around over here by my brother-in-law's house, it's just been phenomenal. I'm trying to take it easy on the thing because I'm still in the break-in period, but man, just horsing around on it, gunning it a little bit, that thing will really straighten your arms out, and we're having a good time out here. So I hope everybody that was out there on the road made it back home safely, made it to your destination safely, and had a good time, man. It's a full speed ahead as we head into now, you know, the good bowl games, try to get into the college football national championship picture, see how that's going to shake out over the next few days as we ride into new year for 2018. And God dang it, 2018 is going to be, we're going to make it a good year. We're going to make it a good year. Last couple years, you know, losing Shona, losing Hershey, a couple other things going on. Been a little bit on the rough side. I ain't pissing, moaning. I ain't complaining. You know, it's those everyday things that every family goes through that has a pet and loved ones and stuff like that. But anyway, looking forward to 2018. I got some good things on the calendar. I'll share them with you very, very soon. And I'm just looking forward to seeing what 2018 has to offer and see what I can make out of 2018. And I'm going to make some chicken salad this year. But anyway, I had a chance to just sit down and shoot the breeze with my brother-in-law, Mitch Bailey. I'll go more into discussion about that relationship here as the podcast starts. Man, I got the chance to hang around Mitch a lot this year, more than I've ever hung around him in the past. We hunted together in Winnemucca in Unit 34, got a badass mule deer. And most of the time we're riding around, man, I'm asking questions about the outdoors because Mitch knows this country, this territory, better than anybody else that I know. And he's a very humble guy. He's a very smart guy. He's a very independent guy and believes in what he believes in, and just a code of honesty and high ethics. And he's a guy that I got a lot of respect for. And I'm always asking him questions about hunting, trapping, and stuff like that, some of the things that he's passionate about and that he does. And I said, man, just listen to you talk about the knowledge of these animals and all the procedures and things that you go through. I said, well, I'll do a podcast about it. So, hey, man, I'm sitting here talking with my brother-in-law, Mitch Bailey, at his house here in Spanish Springs. We're shooting shit. I'm going to keep this open, kind of short, so we can roll into conversation and shoot the breeze, because I want to get outside and I want to get on my Kawasaki four-wheeler. That Brute 4 750 is a bad son, Mitch. I just want to go out there and get some riding in before the sun goes down. Because at this time of the year, the sun goes down pretty damn fast. But before I get to my conversation with my brother-in-law, Mitch Bailey of Nevada Hunting Services, let's take a quick pause for the cause and give big ups to a sponsor who makes this podcast possible, and that's the good folks over at TrueCar. Now, you guys know if you're looking to buy a car, you're probably familiar with terms like MSRP, and you might even know what it stands for. But what does it actually mean? The same goes for invoice, list price, and dealer price. Hey, that's enough to confuse anybody. All you're really looking for is a price that actually means something. Introducing True Price from TrueCar. That's True Price from TrueCar. Now you can know exactly what you'll pay for the car you want, including fees and accessories, before you even get to the dealership. TrueCar dealers will show you the true price on cars like the one you want, all from the comfort of home. And how do you know if your true price is a great price? Because TrueCar shows you what other people pay for the same car you want. And your certified dealers know this, so they set their true price competitively so they can win your business. So when you are ready to buy a new or a used car, that's right, they sell used cars too, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states.
This is Susie Schuster, and I'm with Rich Eisen, my husband. We do not just sports on Podcast One Sportsnet. We've had incredible guests. I mean, if I have to say so myself.
Say it.
Shaquille O'Neal.
Hank
Azaria.
Yes.
Paul Rudd.
Bob Saget.
Jim Harbaugh. Do you know who he is?
Oh, my God. He's my coach.
You can find us exclusively at PodcastOne.com or on the new Podcast One app. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts.
Please don't forget.
This is Steve Austin Unleashed.
All right, I'm rolling this out. I'm over here in Spanish Springs, Nevada, sitting here with my brother-in-law. Fixing to talk about hunting, fishing, trapping, riding four-wheelers. Holy smokes. Dude, how are you?
Fine.
Are you getting tired of me yet?
Yep.
Well, my wife just sat on my Broken Skull Ranch hat and my brand new sunglasses, so I'm mad as a sumbitch. Why would you sit on my sunglasses? You just bought them for me at Costco.
$25.
What brand is that?
Champion.
I didn't know Champion made sunglasses. Polarized lenses. I'm out there looking in the pond over there and I can actually see the fish. That's a lie, because there wasn't no fish in the pond. Mish, did you catch all the fish?
Well, I kind of snuck in here while you were gone, but I think the previous... Oh. Never mind.
Hey, you know what, Mitch? I got about 7 more days, actually 9 more days before we got to head back to California. I've had a blast out here staying with you. We appreciate the hospitality. Have I irritated you in any way, shape, or fashion? Because it's not often that just, you know, you're a regular guy, Mitch. Let's face it. You're a regular guy. You work hard. You work your regular job. You guide. You trap. You do taxidermy work, so it's not often that just a regular guy gets a global icon and a national treasure to come over and just hang out with him. We happen to be brother-in-laws, and since we've grown to be so close over these past few weeks, we've taken the in-law part out. So has your brother Steve pissed you off or stepped on your toes since I've been here?
No, not at all. Not at all. The only thing I think that's missing is another birthday celebration down at the restaurant.
That's our little deal. Every time we go, what's it called? Dos Compadres?
Los Compadres.
Does that mean there's two guys? So every time we go over there, it's either Mitch's birthday or it's my birthday. The other day we went to with Royce and his wife, and I told Mitch, I gave him the old elbow. I said, hey, I think it's somebody's birthday.
I think they were both born on the same day.
They came out with the big sombreros and a shot of tequila. I was surprised when they both shot down those things of tequila because, you know, they did have to drive home, but they were in good shape. They'd only had one drink prior. And in Nevada, It's a little different out here.
This is Nevada, Steve. Having a shot of tequila and wearing a sombrero is just part of every day.
God dang, and no one has ever worn a sombrero quite like you did when you had that big mustard stain on the front of your shirt. It was ridiculous. You look like the biggest crazy kid I'd ever seen in my life. And you was about half lit up, and you're lucky your global icon and national treasure brother drove you home. No, really, are you ready to go back to L.A. or not?
Yeah, I'm ready.
God dang it, man. Hey, Kristen, remember when I went hunting with Mitch?
Yes, I did.
I had shot a badass mule deer, 180 class, Winnemucca, about 80 miles north of Winnemucca. Hey, where were we, technically, geographically?
We were in the Black Rock Range, a little bit west, northwest of Winnemucca there, Black Rock Mountains.
Someone asked me the other day, I told them about my mule deer hunt, and they said, where were you, like in the White Desert? You know, what's the White Desert?
I don't know anything about the White Desert.
He was from California. He might not know what the hell he was talking about.
I'm thinking he was...
I was thinking, yeah, I read about the Black Rock Desert. I know we were in Unit 034. How many acres is Unit 034?
Millions. Millions. That area is a couple hundred miles square anyway. 100 miles long, probably 50 miles wide.
You know, it's funny because one side of the road wasn't Unit 34 and the other side was. If I'd have been out there by myself, I'd have gotten lost. I don't see how you guys tell the territory or get your geographical bearings out here because, first, I ain't got a compass. All the mountains look the same. I need to get a GPS device. Do I need to get a GPS device? I'm a rookie out here, Mitch.
I'd recommend one if you're going to go by yourself. I don't use one, but...
We're just thinking about this. And here's the thing I always tell people. You know the state like the back of your hand. The whole friggin' state is unbelievable. Plus, you have a good way with a sense of directions because you've been doing it since you was a kid. Now, I've been in the woods since I was a kid, but I remember when I was hunting the Piney Woods out there in Georgia. And this is back when the GPS devices weren't so chilly red hot. And sure enough, the thing couldn't get a signal. As I thought I was marking all my waypoints, I was marking them, but it wasn't receiving them because it didn't know where I was. So when I went to see, you know, the route to take to get home, I was shit out of luck because didn't have any waypoints because I wasn't getting a connection to the satellite. So anyway, just imagine, Mitch, if I'd have got lost out there and maybe starved to death or killed by wild animals, no one would have got a chance to see the career that unfolded as a young man named Stunning Steve Austin out there in the woods of Georgia turned into a global icon and a national treasure, your brother, Stone Cold Steve Austin. So I think that if I'm going to spend any more time out here in these gigantic units of the state of Nevada where everything looks the same, and I love this country, but God dang, I need to get a friggin' GPS device. Do you have any recommendations? Okay, thank you for that answer.
Wait, I was getting ready to say something.
Okay, give me some.
I don't know why you got to get so excited. Give a guy a chance to think.
Sorry, I drank 3 cups of coffee before you got up and started doing the podcast. And I thought she was going to go to work or skin some deer heads or do something. Then I drank a Diet Red Bull, so I'm like flying over here. Tell me about a GPS device because I got a story for you.
I think I'd go with a Garmin, one of the good ones nowadays that have all the maps you can download into them, the topographic maps. Put any area you want in there, pick it out, shows all the three-dimensional terrain. That's what I'd go for.
Well, here's me being the cheapskate that I am. I was talking to my wife who's sitting on my left side right now. I would give her a microphone, but I only have 2 microphones right now. Mitch has got the other one. You can pipe right in anytime you want to, Kristen. She probably wants me to get lost, get attacked by a mountain lion. She's had enough of me. But I told Kristen, I said, you know what? I said, here's what I'm going to do when I decide to go out and ride my buggies. Mitch, when he guides, if he's going on a mountain lion hunt, when do you use your dogs? On mountain lions or what?
Mountain lions. Yep.
Okay.
Bears.
Bears too?
Yeah.
Okay, but anyway, when Mitch takes his dogs out, how many dogs you got?
I have 5.
Oh, what kind?
Walker hounds.
Okay, why do you run walker hounds?
Oh, walker hounds, fast dog, looks like a big beagle. They got good legs under them. They're really fast, good noses on them.
Okay, before we get into the, I don't want to talk about the walker dogs, but here's what I was going to do. You got 5 dogs, and I've seen that collar setup you've gotten. So a lot of times when you're out there messing with those mountain lions or whatever, and I figured if I put one of those tracking collars in my pocket, I'm not going to wear it or something, bitch. If I put a tracking collar in my pocket, if I get lost, I just call you and say, hey, man, come find me. Because when you put your collars on a dog, what kind of device or a gimmick thing you got in your hand to tell you where the dogs are?
I have the receiver end. It's a GPS satellite tracking system. Each dog has one. You can do stimulated corrections, too. And if they're running off the wrong direction, you can correct it. But it also tells me exactly where they are up to 20 miles.
See, if I got my dumbass lost, you could find me within 20 miles. Now, here's the thing. I figure you'd probably try to give me, what do you call it, a stimulated...
I was going to say, no
stimulated correction.
Pocket, you might want to wrap it around your neck.
I'd be getting the shit shocked out of me. Mitch is over there looking at me with a spotting scope, looking at me jerk around.
Or I have that thing in my pocket and it's holding the button down and you're flopping around.
I'm like, why are you lighting me up? Why are you lighting me up? Oh, sorry, the button was pushed. Hey, man, when you take your dogs out, what's the longest you've been out, and what do you do when you lose a dog? Are you worried about him? You know you're just going to end up finding him? Are they pretty self-sufficient?
I used to worry about the dogs when I couldn't find them. You know, the new telemetry stuff's only been out for, oh, gosh, 5-6 years. Before that, you had to use a radio frequency with an antenna and try to pinpoint them that way, traveling from one place to another. But with the new stuff, I pretty much know exactly where they are. You know, down to a few feet even. It even tells me the course they took to get to where they are. So I don't worry about them too much. I mean, occasionally you'll lose a signal and you'll lose a dog overnight or that. But in all the years I've been doing it, I've never lost a dog for more than a...
What would them dogs do? Will they keep just trying to run a circle? Will they bed up? What will they do? Just keep running?
Oh, I think when it starts getting dark and that and they haven't... Once they get exhausted, you know, tired from the chase, they'll stop and start milling around and get the chase out of their head and start coming back to where they were let go. Usually if you throw your jacket or something on the ground, you come back in the morning, the dog will be laying on your coat.
Hey, man, tell me about what got you started mountain lion hunting. Because I remember back in the day when I started deer hunting, you know, my stepdad got us out in the woods, and I grew up deer hunting my whole life and did a little bit of bird hunting. I tried to do more dove hunting than I have in the past, but I just haven't had the time, and the Broken Skull Ranch was too far away. Man, I want to go on a mountain lion hunt, and I know that there has been a proliferation or an increase in the number of big cats in Nevada. First of all, how'd you start mountain lion hunting? Let's talk about the increase in the numbers.
All right. Well, I always wanted to see a lion. Typically, you don't get to see them. They're elusive, nocturnal animals, and very few people have ever laid their eyes on them without the use of hounds or at a zoo or whatnot. And just really something I wanted to see and catch. And I had a couple buddies up in Montana and South Dakota that had hounds, and they used them to catch lions for the guy in South Dakota did it for the biologist up there, where they'd go catch them and collar them and track their movements to establish a population. And so I actually talked to him about it the most, and I ended up trading him a couple of rifles for a couple of dogs that he got me. And he'd use them quite a bit on his biology program there, and sent them down in the airplane, and away you go. I started lion hunting, caught my first lion the next day, actually, and that was 250 lions ago.
Hey, man, what do you do with those mountain lions? Because you were telling me the backstrap is delicious.
The whole lion's really pretty darn good. One of the things that I left out was, long before I got into hunting the lions myself, I was out in Ely, Nevada fishing, and I ran into a lion hunter, and me and my buddies went to his house and had beers, and he pulled out a hindquarter out of a mountain lion out, and we barbecued it up and ate it up, and I realized how good it was. It's delicious. Especially the back straps, you know, but the whole lion's consumable, and it's pretty darn good. I've had game feeds at the house where I have back straps of mountain lions on the barbecue, and without anybody knowing what they're eating, they really are quite fond of it and surprised when I tell them what it is.
Hey, man, like right now, is it mountain lion season? Like right now as we speak, is what, December 28th, 29th?
Yeah.
Is it mountain lion season right now?
It is.
Is it year-round?
You can hunt them year-round, but... Most guys wait till the snow hits so they can track them a little easier.
So what's the MO if you're going to take off mountain lion hunting?
Well, I'm probably going to do a little bit of homework, you know, and find a place where there's a good lion, look for tracks, get all set up for it, and then we usually wait for a little bit of weather to where we get some good snow conditions to look for lion tracks and get out there with you and turn the dog loose on the track and see if they can put it up a tree or in a rock slide or something where we can get a good look at it.
How smart is a mountain lion?
Lions that have been chased are pretty tough. You know, a lion that's been treed quite a few times or met up with the dogs, usually they won't tree so much and hold. They'll jump from tree to tree, or they'll get in a good rock pile. There's a lion we caught this year that I'd been after for a year and a half, and he'd get in those caves and tunnels and make his way past the dogs and get into an area where the dogs were having a tough time keeping up with him and elude them. But they can smarten up pretty good. They have a good memory, that's for sure.
So what is the deal about the dogs being able to catch the lions? It's just because they'll trim, or they'll rock up, or whatever you're saying, because they'll just try to make a stand or just get away to stop running? Do the dogs outlast the cats? What's the psychology behind that?
Well, you're going to find a lion track to start it out with, and that lion track could be an hour or 2 days old. So that lion could be 10 miles away, or he could be 500 yards away. You never know. The real race doesn't start until the dogs see the lion or get close enough to the lion. So you let your dogs loose. They're typically not making any noise at all. They're working the track. Once they work that track to a place where they've crossed the lion, they see the lion, they open up and start bawling pretty good. The noise is what scares the lion. Scared to death of that loud noise, wants to get away from it. He'll get up into a tree, get away from everything, and look down. And sometimes if he sits up there long enough, he'll just fall asleep. But you know, dogs will push him up those trees and hold him pretty good. When a dog gets a lion on the ground, the lion doesn't have a lung capacity like a hound. A hound can run all day. A lion's short-winded. Quick burst for killing. You know, that's how they hunt. Quick, fast burst of energy. But they can't sustain it very long. They have small lungs. And, you know, if the dogs are on top of them, when they meet them up at first, they'll usually just grab a place to turn around. And that could be a rock pile or an area where there's no trees. It could be a piece of sagebrush. Anything to get away from the dogs.
Okay, but then what would happen if there was just a face-to-face close encounter with the dog and the cat? And let's just say the cat has regained its wind, and now it's just the dog versus the mountain lion. Mountain lion's going to have a size advantage, but what's the story on that? Is it strength in numbers of the dogs, or does it go down like that?
It could. I mean, you get a lion with one or two dogs, even three dogs, but I've caught many lions with one dog. It's just that barking in its face, and a good dog will keep them at bay with their bark, you know, their bawl. But seldom is it a case of an actual fight. The lion backs up, he'll defend himself if the dogs get too close, but a dog that's played the game before knows to only get so close or get in and back out and keep pushing that thing to hold tight.
Now, have you had to employ some veterinary skills with injuries sustained to a dog out there in the woods?
I have, sure. Sure, every houndsman's got a little first aid kit for his dogs, but I've never had a dog killed by a lion. We've had some pretty good tussles, you know, but oftentimes that lion, when he could do something, doesn't. More interested in getting away than attacking.
When you add a new dog to the mix because one has gotten too old, you've retired it, or maybe it passed or whatever, does the dog that you bring in, is he just monkey see, monkey do, he's following the other guys and he catches on, or has this the new dog been put through a training program?
Most
or is it kind of inbred to them or in their instincts?
Most of the training I give my dogs is more, you know, loading up in the dog boxes, behavior issues with the other hounds, you know, what's tolerated. I don't allow barking in the dog box in the truck. I don't allow them to bark when they're in the same, you know, compartment with each other. It's nuisance barking. So most of the training I give them is just behavior stuff, you know, holding still while I get their collars on them, get them ready to go. You don't want to be fighting all those dogs. But as far as the actual chase and the treeing and that, it's just repetitive work with the dogs, with each other. You know, it used to be when I didn't, you know, have a seasoned veteran in the bunch, you'd actually have to take them out and do drag scents, you know, with some scent and a dummy and drag it around and teach them to trail. But I don't do so much of that anymore. I've got, you know, some older dogs. The younger ones just pick it up from them.
Man, I've been wanting to go on a mountain lion hunt with you whenever I get the time. And we had a successful mule deer hunt right outside of Winnemucca in Unit 034. And, man, I had a blast. And that was one of my – out of all the years I've been hunting, and I guess I've been hunting over 45 years, that was one of the coolest things, because that was out here in this area, not under – over bait, you know, like you can in Texas, but the brush country is a totally different system. But nonetheless, it's been fun being out here.
What's with the proliferation?
Well, oh, yeah, we want to get to that. But before we get to the proliferation, why there's so many more cats here in Nevada, it has to do with California. I was going to let you jump in here, Kristen, and tell our mountain lion story. Because although we're from Texas, well, we have a ranch in Texas. You're from California. We had. Remember the first night we bought the ranch? When we bought that place, we had heard that there was a mountain lion in the area. And you don't get a whole lot of mountain lions in South Texas, but they are there. And then we were riding around. You remember the story?
I thought it was a different type of cat.
No, it was a mountain lion. Oh. All right, I'll tell the story. So there we were. It's supposed to be a mountain lion on the property. The first night we had bought the property, or the first night Kristen was there, and we got in a Bronco. Of course, I had to make that last ride. And, of course, I'd had a few. And we were driving down the road, and God dang, just to your point, Mitch, and it was dark, so maybe that's why we saw him. Man, God dang, mountain lion, panther, whatever you want to call it, just ran right out in front of the Bronco and into the brush. Had a tail on it about that long. It wasn't no damn bobcat. It was a big ass, probably not the size of the cats out here. But I looked at Kristen. She looked at me and said, it's a goddamn mountain lion. There he was. And so, actually, Kristen saw one of them, and I saw two of them. Because I had been drinking so much.
I thought you were talking about the ocelot that we saw.
No, we saw ocelot, and we saw a lot of bobcats, but no, that was the mountain lion we saw that night. Talk to me, Mitch, because I want to get into some other subject matter. I want to talk to you about trapping, but talk to me about the proliferation or the increase in the cats seen here in Nevada, because you've been talking, and you've been trapping a lot this year, and you've been catching a few mountain lions, and you're not trying to catch them, but why is there an increase in the mountain lions in Nevada?
Well, you have a pretty robust population in California, but starting off with that, you know, go back and read some books that were, when I started lion hunting, I started reading books, and, you know, the books were written 50s, 60s, and they talked about the territorial male mountain lion and the females and how many female lions would be in his territory, so to speak, and how he patrolled his territory and had scent posts and how he marked his territory to keep the other breeding age males out. So you wouldn't see too many lions on one mountain range. You might have one male and a couple females, and then they'd breed and have some kittens, and the kittens would become juveniles and leave the area. So all that is pretty much out the window anymore. So when you have the state of California stopped mountain lion hunting or even possessing a mountain lion in the late 70s, the population grew, and it continued to grow with only maybe incidental captures or incidental, you know, car wrecks hitting a lion or something like that. But the only place for them to go, because you got an ocean on one side and a border on this side, is into Nevada. So they've crossed into areas of Nevada that didn't used to have lions that have pretty good populations of them. Now, we were able to hold our own, I think, with the amount of lions coming in just with sport hunting and government hunting and keeping the lions under control. And then, you know, you have incidental catches by the bear hunters and the trappers in California who now can't do either of those. So we're getting more and more of them here. And our deer herds are whittling down pretty bad. The Western Nevada deer population is about 20% of what it was in the 80s, and it's not getting any better. So I know myself, when I'm out on my trap line or I'm out hunting lions, it's not a problem to find several. It's not a problem to find four or five dominant males in the same canyon, where that wasn't how it was ever viewed or studied in the past, but that's what's happening.
Hey, man, when I was doing some research on mountain lions, they can saw through a deer herd real quick. But as far as a human, as far as like a human being out there, they're pretty shy. It's not like they want to go kill a human being.
No.
They're kind of scared of the human being.
Yeah.
So are they a danger if they wanted to be? Well, absolutely, of course, because of how deadly they are. So what's the story? Is it about, you know, as far as all the mountain lion tags being available in Nevada, is there a certain limit to how many they will sell and how much of a dent, well, you just told me the percentage, but other than the mule deer, what else are those guys out there trying to eat?
Well, that's the other thing. So we don't, a mountain lion's going to eat prey, you know, they're the old books will tell you porcupines were their primary source. That's what they chose to eat more than anything else. And then mule deer, probably second down on the list. And then whatever else they can eat, whether it's wild horses or rodents or whatnot. But the thing about a lion is they have to eat. That's what they do. They kill and they eat. And they kill prey animals and they eat them. So you're going to find lions, in especially with the diminishing deer herds, they'll switch to something else. So you're going to find lions, and plenty of them, wherever the food source is. And then once that food source is down to nothing, they'll eat whatever's left or move on. So you get an area with a high population of mountain lions, which California's got plenty of them, and we're getting them here too, that food source could be anything. And it could be the playground at a grammar school. It could be who knows what. And we've had quite a few lions show up in parking lots at elementary schools along the California border here, where we have towns and that, and it's a real concern.
Okay, so as far as the mountain lion goes, is that the top of the food chain other than man?
It is. I don't know what else there might be other than black bears, but mountain lion's pretty much the top of the predator food chain, and the only basically animal that preys upon mountain lions is a human being.
Okay, but descend down from Earth. So it'd be human being, mountain lion, and then give me the next three, because I know where's a coyote, bobcat going to come in?
No, I think they're right up there. Coyotes especially, they prey upon anything. They're right up there at the top of that chain too. You got to throw the wolf into there, and fortunately Nevada has very few wolves, but they're starting to come this way too. And that, they might help control the lion population. But coyotes, bobcats, they're right in there. Coyotes probably more so than the bobcats.
So how do they go about determining how many tags for mountain lions are going to be sold?
Like with mule deer, they get in a helicopter or an airplane. They fly over areas where the deer winter, and they can get good numbers and make an estimate on what the population is, the buck to doe ratios, fawn survival, and establish a quota. With mountain lions, there really is no way of identifying how many there are in any area other than information that they gather from trappers and hunters that see them in the field. But they do an estimate, and their quota for the state is they divide the state up into three regions, and they have a quota for each region, and the quota is how many lions they will allow to be killed on a year-to-year basis. And in the 20 years that I've been hunting them, they've never met the quota. It's not because there's not a lot of lions. It's because it's a tough animal to catch with dogs. There's not a lot of houndsmen out there that do this because it's time-consuming, expensive, hard on equipment, and your success isn't all that great either. So The quota hasn't been met, but that's how they establish, how many can be killed. They feel like more lions are being killed than should be, then the quota will be met, and they'll turn it off.
Then who would be tougher on the deer herd? Because, man, you'd always been telling me every time you came down to Broken Skull Ranch to hunt, and you go, man, Steve, you need to shoot all these coyotes. For a while, I wasn't shooting them, and then we started shooting them, and you said, man, they'll definitely whittle in on your deer population. And I was like, man, these little ass coyotes we got over here, I don't know what kind of damage they could do. And they run in packs. But I saw on Instagram one of the guys I follow, I can't remember which one it was, and a bunch of coyotes up here in Nevada. I think it was Nevada or Utah or somewhere up in this general area.
Chris Lacy.
It might have been Chris Lacy. But anyway, man, there was a mule deer, and, man, they had been attacking it from the back end.
Yeah.
And there was about three or four of them surrounding it, so that mule deer was still alive, but he was in harm's way, and he was under a lot of duress. Who takes more deer, the packs of coyotes or the mountain lions?
I don't believe it's even packs of coyotes. I think the coyotes have a heck of a time with the mule deer fawns. When those does start dropping the fawns, they're no challenge at all for a single coyote. Definitely the coyotes kill more deer than the lions. The lions continue to eat deer, though. That's what they survive on, where coyotes will eat anything. It's been proven that coyotes can be complete vegetarians or carnivores. They eat everything. They're omnivores, really. And, you know, they wipe out the fawns pretty good. They're hard on the antelope and the deer fawns. And, you know, in the dead of winter when the deer are bigger and that, it's fairly commonplace. I've watched it. I've watched 3 or 4 coyotes take down a deer and kill it. Probably to answer your question, the coyotes are definitely more damaging as far as the amount of animals they kill.
Is a coyote more opportunistic than a mountain lion from a sense of sometimes it will follow a mountain lion and eat what the mountain lion has left behind?
For sure. For sure. That's the thing. You know, they'll say a mature lion will kill a deer a week, but, you know, that's if he can come back and what he killed is still there to eat. There's a good chance when he comes back, what he's killed and tried to cover with twigs and that is gone because coyotes have come in and eaten it or the birds, but coyotes definitely follow the deer around and eat off the kills, you bet.
Okay, before we jump into the second segment of the podcast, and we want to segue into trapping, and the reason that there needs to be trapping, or at least here in Nevada, and a lot of people have outlawed it, our states have banned it, but give me your summation, because we've talked about this before when we was riding down the road at the Deer Creek Ranch out there in Winnemucca on my mule deer hunting, and you were talking about just the predators and prey and their eyes, and how that prey is always trying to fight, you know, for its next day. Take me through that. You know, you remember what I'm talking about?
I think so. The what's the difference between a predator and a prey animal and that? And I can talk about that a little bit. I also want to talk about that the trapping that you're mentioning and more specifically trapping coyotes as opposed to some of the others. But so the prey animal is born into the world and it's got one thing in common with every other prey animal, and that's something trying to kill it. That's why they call it a prey animal. It's preyed upon by predators, and their eyes are on the side of their head. That's how they defend themselves. They can see forward. They can see on both sides of their head, where the prey animal is vulnerable to the predator, who has his eyes in the front of his head and is focused more on the kill and what's straight ahead of him, not necessarily defending himself. So if you put that in place, you know, you can tell what's a predator, what's a prey animal, and we sure have an awful lot of predators running around out there, including the lions and the coyotes.
Before we go into segment two, we're going to talk about trapping, and it's an interesting thing because my brother's sitting beside me. I'm in the middle. My wife is sitting on the other side of me, and my wife didn't like trapping at all, but my brother's been trapping his entire life. He's got a reason for it. They differ in their opinions. Nonetheless, coming back on segment two, we're going to talk about trapping.
2017 was a great year for us here at Podcast One, and we hope it was a great year for you.
We launched new shows with Caitlin Bristow, Jim Harbaugh, Dick Enberg, and Randy Jackson.
We've had some amazing guests stop by some of our shows, like Brian Cranston on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus on All of the Above with Norman Lear.
And Jason Bateman on Spike's Car Radio with Spike Ferriston.
We are looking forward to a bright 2018 with new shows coming online, like MySpace Tom Anderson.
And we are welcoming back Dennis Miller to the podcast scene.
This is Heather Dubrow. Happy holidays. Cheers.
I'm Caitlin Bristow, and I want to wish you happy holidays.
Hey, guys, it's Kelsey Knight from the Lady Gang. Happy holidays. We'll see you in the new year.
From all of us here at Podcast One, we want to wish you a very happy holiday and a happy new year.
This is Steve Austin, Unleashed.
All right, I'm rolling sound again. Welcome back to part two of the podcast. I'm sitting here talking to my brother Mitch Bailey of Nevada Hunting Services. Guy's been hunting, fishing, trapping, outdooring it his whole life. Hell, I've been doing my thing in South Texas, now doing it by way of Nevada. Callie, what's your nickname?
Cal-Cal.
Yeah, we got a bunch of nicknames for that dog. Callie is chewing on a bully stick in the background. If you heard that during the first segment, that's her. If you hear me breathing in the microphone, it's because I got all these deviated septums from my nose being busted up too much. But Callie is over there chewing the shit out of a damn bully stick. And if it wasn't for that, she'd be barking at us to throw the tennis ball. Moolah is happily content to be asleep on the couch. I tire these dogs out here. I get them their exercise. Nonetheless, Mitch, you want to talk about trapping?
Yeah, I do.
Well, what do you want to talk about trapping?
We'll talk about a little bit of everything. What we trap, where we trap, why we trap,
Well, let's talk about why we trap, because I was doing some research before we did the podcast, and we've been riding up down the road together all deer season and for the last few weeks. But when I started reading about trapping, shit, they've been trapping, man, going back, I'll have my computer in front of me. It was like 35 or 4,500 BC or some kind of period. Whether it was, god dang, it was the weighted, like if it was like a stone that weighed at a lever like this, you knock a stick at it, get squashed.
Yep.
Going from pit traps where they just dig a hole in the ground to, god dang, I started reading about the first man traps, you know, when they were trying to catch poachers from doing shit.
Yeah.
And then I guess in the 1800s. Did you know the Europeans were the first guys to come across here to start trapping beavers and trading with the Native Americans?
Yeah, I did. Trapping trading posts, the mountain men, the fur traders. Big business. It was one of the biggest businesses in this country in the early days. That's what they traded with the Indians. The Indians traded with them. They traded with each other. Furs was a big deal, you know. It's part of our heritage, that's for sure.
Well, it's part of our heritage, and I don't do it, and it's not my thing, but you've been doing it for a long time. Some of the people don't like deer hunting, and more power to them, whatever. I'm a deer hunter. I'm a hunter in general. I'm proud to be. But a lot of people, you know, don't understand the need or necessity for trapping. Break that down for me or for someone that they can understand where a trapper's mindset is coming from, along with it being heritage and tradition.
Yeah, I'm going to do it. And you might not even realize this, but you are a trapper. I think a lot of people don't realize at what level do you become a trapper. I think every grocery store in this area sells traps. Fly traps, mouse traps, wasp traps, you name it. They're traps. It's what you use. You bait them to catch an animal that's causing you displeasure, annoyance, or you just want to get a fur out of it. Who knows? But that's the case. Trapping is at all different levels. The level I trap at is for fur bears, obviously. But, you know, same thing. You get a mouse in your house, you run down and get a mouse trap. What kind do you get? Kind that clobbers them over the head, or the kind they get stuck to, or the kind that they just walk into and they can't get out? All of them are traps, and you bait them with something. So that kind of establishes that we as North Americans or human beings, we all pretty much have some sort of a trap that we've used, or most people have. So for me, I like to trap, I do trap pack rats and mice around my place here, and I do that here at the house, and then, you know, during fur bear season, I go out and trap coyotes and bobcats and things like that, and it is, it's my culture, my heritage, it's something I'm very sincere about, and it means a lot to me, and it's challenging, rewarding, financially rewarding, emotionally rewarding, and it's just what I do, I've learned it over the course of my life, and it's something I really value.
By your own words, as we were riding down the road in the truck, you said it. Trapping is what it is. By nature, it is very barbaric because you're trapping an animal. That device is holding the animal until you dispose of it. Yep. and do what you do. You're there to take the hide. For you, when you're thinking, is it the monetary gain from trapping, selling the hide, or is it twofold? That, along with the fact that you're trying to rid the territory of some predators so that the prey animals, the deer and whatnot, can survive. What's your mindset as you go about doing what you've learned and grew up doing since you was a kid?
Well, you know, early on when I was a kid trapping, I didn't just start out trapping fur bears or coyotes or bobcats and that. I'd pick up little jobs removing nuisance pigeons from somebody's property with a bird trap, you know, take the birds out, release them or dispose of them, rodent control. I've had beaver projects where I've removed beavers from people's ranches that were causing damage to their trees on the ranch along the canals and stuff. For me, it's twofold. It's I get to go out, enjoy the outdoors. There's no better way that I know of than enjoying the outdoors running a trap line. You're out there by yourself in conditions that might be beautiful or they might be pretty rough. You know, it could be snowing, raining, windy. It could be dark. You run into all kinds of problems with your equipment. And that's the challenge that's pretty darn alluring to me. It's just me in the outdoors, my trap line, trying to catch animals and fur bears, which they're beautiful in their own right. I'm rewarded when I have a good catch. When I sell my furs at auction, I'm rewarded financially. Kind of covers the costs associated with it. Nobody ever really makes a ton of money doing it anymore, but it's my heritage. It's what I do, and it's part of our culture, and I would like to keep that culture alive, of course. Not just for me, my kids have done it too. They both trapped with me as young girls too, and it has a benefit. The benefit, you know, obviously when you go into a place and pull some coyotes out of the area that might already be overrun with them, it's going to have nothing but benefits to the population of prey around where those coyotes are, and that could be deer, antelope, rabbits, could be a lot of things. Same thing with a bobcat area. You go into an area and catch a bunch of bobcats, the chukar bird population is going to increase, the songbirds are going to increase, the rabbits. So you just got to balance. You know, you never go into an area and totally wipe it out. You have to have some predators, but I don't know that a trapper's ever going to completely wipe a place out, but good common sense, you manage the predator preys there.
What's the difference between if you're out there trying to trap coyotes versus bobcats? Is there a difference in the traps? Is there a difference in the setup? What's the story?
Typically, I use the same trap for both. So, good coyote set. You know, I'm going to go into an area, sandy washes, travel ways. They don't really like the tall brush all that much. They like to see what's in front of them. And I'll get into a sandy wash where the coyotes like to travel. They really like roads. Coyotes love the roads. They love to mark the roads, traveling the roads. They can see, you know, they like to have good vision when they're in there. And so I'll set up a dirt hole set where I'll dig a little hole, a tunnel into the ground, and that gathers their interest. Like they believe maybe a rodent bored a hole into an embankment, and they go stick their nose in there looking for it. And I'll bury my trap, you know, in front of that, cover it, sift some dirt over it, and make sure I don't leave any scent around it. Very, very careful leaving scent around a coyote set. You'll never get rid of all your scent. Their noses are too good for that, but you can try to reduce the amount of your human scent around an area like that where you're trapping coyotes. Bobcats, on the other hand, just like a house cat, they're curious. You find the way they walk. They're lazy. They're going to walk the easiest route they can from point A to point B. You try to find that trailway and set your trap on it. And I pretty much just set my trap on the ground and use some stepping stones and walking sticks to guide them into my trap. And they'll usually walk right in there and get their foot hung up.
Who's more leery, a coyote or a bobcat?
Well, coyotes for sure.
Just because of the nose?
Their nose is so good, and they're very smart. I've had them roll on my traps that are buried to spring them. I've had them dig them up from underneath and flip them over and even relieve themselves on it before. They're pretty smart animals.
So, man, going back to Jeremiah Johnson is one of our favorite movies. You've probably seen it 50 times. I've probably seen it 30, and we always go through the dialogue and say the lines. The story about, I guess they were trapping beaver, him and the boy they got from the crazy woman, and they're pouring the beaver scent. Or what was the scent they were pouring over that trap to get away from their scent? What was that?
I think they were putting down beaver castor gland.
So you don't do that. Are you using rubber gloves, or what are you? Are you trying to, you're trying to disguise your scent or leave as little as possible? So I guess my question is, do you use any form of that?
With coyotes, yeah, I use a lure. Typically it's coyote urine with a little glycerin in it, some asafoetida, and maybe some fermented fish, all fermented down into a liquid. We're not allowed to use bait or exposed bait of any type in Nevada, so it's just a scent lure is all I'm using. Very small amount. I might lure it up one time. Their noses are so good they can smell it a month later. I even made a comment to a trapper buddy of mine one time when I was first starting out about we ought to lure these up every day or every time we check. And he said, why would we do that? I go, well, because I can't smell it anymore. He said, well, they can.
The other day I was talking to you, and you're about to get on your ATV and run your trap line. Tell me about the current trap lines you set, or you're running right now, because I know with work and your taxidermy and all the skulls coming in from deer season, you've been real busy. But you've set trap lines that were up to 250 miles in length.
I have, yeah, in the past.
That's probably in your younger days when you had a little bit more energy or a little bit more time on your hands?
More time, more energy, for sure, more motivation. But, you know, I find it just as fun to put a small line in and work at it, you know, and enjoy myself taking long hikes to get to my traps. I find it just as enjoyable and rewarding as I did when I ran 200 traps over 250 miles. You know, at that point, it becomes more like a job. It's a lot harder, takes more time, but, you know, and for an enjoyment part of it, you know, smaller trap line's a lot of fun. Not out to make a fortune, just out to have a good time and see what I can catch, test my skills.
What kind of mechanical malfunctions have you had out in the woods, whether it pertained to the four-wheeler or UTV you're riding versus, I mean, as experienced as you are, you ever got your hand caught in a trap, or have you ever just royally screwed up in some fashion?
You know, I get my hands stuck in traps all the time, and I'm glad you brought that up, because we just did a video for the Sporting Dog Alliance on how to release your dog or your pet from a foothold trap. And part of the video, we demoed actually putting our hands in a trap and letting it fire on us and how to remove it rather than, you know, doing it with a pet. They don't break bones. They don't cause injury. They're designed to release or the trigger releases and the jaws clamp onto you, but not to break bones or cut your skin or tear you apart. It's to hold you. So it's not a problem if I get my hand stuck in a trap. I put my hand in a trap all the time and just release the levers and let myself out. It's pretty simple. Some of the problems I've had with equipment, you know, from flat tires to, you know, just the other day I was telling you about my ATV ride out of there when I, you know, probably 10 degrees outside, freezing cold, and jumped on my ATV and I heard a little snap. And I thought, man, a rock must have fell out of my boot or something. And couldn't find anything, and I fired up the ATV and went to reach for the throttle, and it wasn't there anymore. So I kind of had to ride about 10 miles through the rocks, twisting the darn screw on the bottom of the throttle lever with my fingers, without gloves, because I couldn't hang on to it with the gloves. So by the time I got back to my truck, it was pretty cold out there. Flat tires. Drove my truck off the road one time to park it in the bushes and hit a boulder and busted my drive line. That was 40 miles from home, so that was a doozy.
What did you do when you were 40 miles from home? Did you walk back? Did you call your buddy? What did you do?
Well, I kind of walked until I got cell coverage, and I don't know, it was probably 10 miles.
Who came and got you?
I believe Eric came and got me on that one.
So you flipped your Polaris for one time, too,
did you? Oh, I flipped all of them, yeah. Yeah, the Ranger, the quads, all of them, that's pretty common. I'll tell you something about flipping an ATV or even a Ranger. I flipped five times in one day on an ATV, and end over backwards, end over forward, sideways, you name it. And I can't remember one time I was going more than 5 miles an hour when they flipped.
Really?
Always when you're taking off or you're up against a bush and you throttle it up and it just thing climbs right up that bush and over you go. Never more than 5 miles an hour.
How often you had to winch yourself out or use a winch?
Oh, boy, when that snow hits, I get stuck pretty often. I got a winch on all the ATVs, and most of the time I'm trapping out of a Ranger or an ATV. I try to get away from where most people would go, try to get off the beaten path so to avoid conflict. You know, with somebody that's out walking their dog or bird hunting, you know, with a dog, I try to get away from where most people would go, and that ATV allows me to get away from them.
Man, I was reading Wikipedia about trapping the other day, and they were talking about, God dang, where was it? It was someplace here in the United States, or was it Newfoundland? Someone was out walking on a trail, dog got in a trap, and it was one of the suffocating traps, and the dog died, and there was a lot of legal hassle over it. So I guess there's a lot of flack about non-target animals getting caught in a trap. And in an instance like that, oh, dude, what do you do? Seems to me like there's heat in general towards how barbaric it is just to trap and hold the animal, much less a non-target animal. And in other cases, you've caught mountain lions, but you actually caught a dog the other day in one of your traps.
I did.
And then you told my wife about it, and then my wife got all bent out of shape because my wife is the biggest animal lover I ever met and biggest dog lover I ever met. And she was really upset that your trap caught a dog and you was able to release the dog and the dog walked away, you know, to go do whatever he was doing. But what are your thoughts on that?
You know, here's the thing. So I'm on my trap line, and in the last trap I checked that day, it was actually Christmas morning, so just a few days ago, and I mean, I'm 5 miles up the side of the mountain and a pretty good walk to get up into these little cliffs. It's a bobcat set, and I walked up to that trap, and there was a little pit bull, gray pit bull, sitting there with my trap on its foot, and first of all, I was shocked that there was a dog up there that far from the nearest. There were no homes, there's nothing with 10 miles. I mean, it's a long way from anywhere. And, you know, it's the last thing I want to catch is somebody's dog. And I love dogs too, you know. So the first challenge is, okay, is this dog going to let me walk up to it? You know, because it's scared. And what's it going to do to me? And I try to walk up and be cautious without portraying myself as being scared too. Because if it knows I'm scared, it's probably going to get bit. So I walked up and it wagged its tail a little bit, you know, and I got to the place where I could pet it, still worried it was going to bite me. And we established a little bit of a trust thing there, and then I just reached down and released the levers, and the dog pulled its foot out, got up and walked away, and it hobbled around on three legs for about 5-6 steps and then put all its weight on its feet and walked around sniffing things and followed me around a little bit and then just walked off. So it worked out pretty darn good there.
It worked out okay with the pit bull, but I've seen a couple of times you and me have talked or you sent me some pictures and you caught some mountain lions in your traps, and you're not trying to catch mountain lions, and you can't take a mountain lion or dispatch, what's the word I should use here, of a mountain lion while it's in a trap.
Right.
So that's not your goal.
That's
so
right.
What's protocol? What happens? Because you've caught some big-ass lions this year in traps.
Big lions.
And there have been some hairy situations.
Absolutely. So because of the number of lions are out there and because I'm trapping cats, bobcat, mountain lion, really no difference. They're cats. They have the same habits. It's hard to differentiate between the two. One's just, you know, 100 pounds bigger. I have caught way too many this year, and it's because there are so many. So, you know, I think I shared that little video with you, the one there right out off the highway there where we caught that male, about 125, 130-pound male lion, and caught him in a trap. And here we're not allowed, because they're a game animal, trapping is not a legal method of take for big game in this state. So they've got to be released from a trap, whether you call the department to do it or whether you are capable of doing it yourself. I've dealt with quite a few of them, hunting them with hounds and having trapped for many years, I've dealt with quite a few. So I carry a catch pole in my rig. It's similar to what the dog catcher uses to catch a dog without getting bit. It's a loop on the end of a stick with a handle, and like a little rope with a lawnmower pull start on it, you know, a little handle to get a hold of, and slip it around their head and tighten it up and pull their head away so they can't bite you while your buddy gets in there and pulls the trap off. Pretty harrowing experience anyway to have a 130-pound all-muscle beast at the end of your 5-foot stick that would just soon tear your head off as let you mess with him like that. But I do. I release a lot of them myself and do it that way. And, you know, couple minutes after you get the trap off, they'll usually get up and walk away and shake it off and away they go. Had another one that same night where I got the Department of Wildlife in there because it was getting dark and I didn't have any help, and they came in and darted that lion, and we hauled it off, and they radio called it, and they're going to do a study on it. So as a trapper, that was my way of helping them with their study. I think they've got two or three radio collared lions this year that they otherwise wouldn't be able to get that data from had I not caught them.
Is it legal for you to carry a dart gun yourself, or did you just call the state to do that?
Well, I think it's legal. I'm sure it's legal to carry the gun, but the drug they use is something that I don't have access to. And they're even checking. They've got that little toolbox with their narcotics in it that they have to check out each dosage before they leave the office.
Dude, you ain't never had a come to Jesus meeting with one of them cats, because you've been through some pretty good scrapes. I mean, that time you called me the other day, you said that was one of the few times you've really been scared.
Yeah, that's for sure. I've had some pretty good experiences with them and in traps, you know. And I'll tell you a story about, I think, the time that I think I was the most scared in my whole life on the trap line, actually. So we have these birds up here called chukar birds, you know, they're ground dwellers like quail and that. And I was trapping up in the Fox Range, and I walked up the wash there where I had some coyote sets, and there was my stake wadded up like a pretzel, and a stake is what I'd pounded my trap into the ground with to hold it. And the stake was sitting there in the ground just like somebody pulled it out, wadded it up, and put it back in the ground, and the trap was gone. And darn, something big was here. I walk up the wash, and I had another trap the same way, and there was the stake, and trap was gone. Oh, my God. I followed all the busted-down bushes and everything, thinking, I got a lion or two in a trap here. We got trouble. And I walked up to the last bush that wasn't torn down, and I walked up to it with my gun in my hand, waiting to see if what was in there, and a whole covey of chukar blew out and about scared the crap out of me.
Kristen, are you okay?
Yeah.
We told the story about the pit bull getting caught in a trap.
Yeah.
And then you blew your brother's phone up when he had told you that he'd, are you okay with the trapping? Do you like it? You not like it?
I don't like it, but I respect what my brother does, so.
You've been out of shape the other day.
Well, it's just because he was giving me shit about it.
Yeah, but you were giving him shit about it.
That's what brothers and sisters do.
Yeah. You catch any backlash? I mean, because the few weeks now that I've been here in Nevada, man, it, to me, it really seems like everybody's into the hunting thing, and they get it all. Yeah. Where do you get any flack back? Because I know there's a lot of anti-trapping groups that are trying to, they shut down trapping in California, mm-hmm. and are trying to, I guess, impose their will on Nevada. Do you see that happening? Or
absolutely, there's a big movement here in this state to influence hunting and trapping with the same approach they took in California. And it's unfortunate that our culture and our heritage is being challenged by the few who don't believe in it or support it. You know, people just like my illustrious sister, she's entitled to her opinion, and I'm entitled to mine. And I'm entitled to my way of life, and she's entitled to hers, but I don't think it's right that we should impose our beliefs on each other and make each other, you know, suffer the consequence. I mean, really, to take hunting away from me, what else would I live for? And that's what I do. It's what my family does, and it's what my friends do, and I don't know that a good thing would be to take that away just because some don't believe in it. It there's a value to it, and we all have to learn how to get along. But you know, here in Nevada, we're getting a lot of people moving in from out of state, and they find it very difficult to believe that people trap. They thought it was something that went away in the 1800s, and it didn't go away, and it's still very prosperous. It's still prevalent in 90% of the states in this country, and there's a value to it. If there wasn't, it wouldn't be. But they come here and try to change our rules and our way of life, and I think they need to base their opinions, I think, more on facts than emotions.
Hey, man, before we ride off in the sunset, is there a website or place that people can go see that video that y'all posted about how to remove the dog's foot from a trap?
Absolutely. That's the Nevada Sporting Dog Alliance. It was founded by some houndsmen in Nevada, some really quality people put the alliance together, and we just did a video on that. It's NevadaSportingAlliance.com.
And on are you on Twitter or just Instagram?
Just Instagram.
On Instagram, he is at Nevada Hunting Services.
I am at Nevada Hunting Services, and back to the Nevada Sporting Dog Alliance. They're on Facebook also.
Anything else you want to add before we ride off in the sunset?
No, I think we're probably doing pretty good.
We're doing pretty good, and I could use a whiskey. Do I have a drinking partner?
Do I have one?
I'm asking you, do I have a drinking partner?
Absolutely, Steve.
I'm signing off. Steve Austin with my brother Mitch Bailey out here in the wilds of Nevada, enjoying the mountains, the cold weather, and it's an awesome vibe. Enjoyed it, Mitch.
My name is Raven, professional wrestling superstar, raconteur extraordinaire, and other adjectives. Or is it adverbs? Anyway, join me and a motley assortment of friends, enemies, ne'er-do-wells, and know-nothings as we banter about all kinds of nonsense every Monday here at the Jericho Network on Podcast One. Download and listen to the show on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts. Quote to Raven, nevermore.
All right, everybody, give me the go-home cues. Time to wrap up this podcast and ride off in the sunset. Before I do that, I want to thank my brother, Mitch, sitting there shooting the breeze for me. It's good to talk to a human being live and in living color right here in front of me. As I told you guys a couple of weeks ago, I've gotten a lot of emails and a lot of comments on Twitter. A lot of you enjoyed the conversation I had with Brutus the Barber Beefcake. I enjoyed that myself. So I'm fixing to have Brutus on again. We're going to talk a little about going to Japan and wrestling and the game over there. And a couple other people from the wrestling world that I've been wanting to talk to coming up real soon on the Steve Austin Show. But before I let you go, folks, all those shirts that I wore this past season of Broken Skull Challenge are available at ProWrestlingTees.com/Steve Austin. The best damn IPA on the planet, Broken Skull IPA. It's available in California at Whole Foods and Total Wines. If you don't live in Cali, check out InsideTheCellar.com and see if they ship to your state. And if you're looking for a badass pocket knife, check out the Cold Steel Broken Skull Knife or the new Working Man's Knife at my new Amazon store. Amazon has the best price on both knives. Just go to Amazon.com/shop/Steve Austin. And I want to say one more time, thank you very much to all the fine sponsors of the Steve Austin Show. That's how I'm able to do this podcast for you twice a week for free. You can find all my sponsors at PodcastOne.com. Just click on the Killer Deals button at the top of the page and then click on the Steve Austin Show banner. And speaking of Podcast One, the new Podcast One app is now available for download at the App Store or Google Play. There ain't another podcast app like this one anywhere, and that's because the new Podcast One app is loaded with some cool-ass features that let you do a lot more than just listen to your favorite shows. You can access behind-the-scenes photos, articles, and connect with other fans of the shows you like. Watch over 1,000 360 virtual reality videos. You can actually watch some of your favorite shows in virtual reality. Hell, it's like you're sitting right in the same room with them. So get to the App Store, Google Play, and download the new Podcast One app now. Folks, until next time, my name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road.
Download new episodes of Steve Austin Unleashed every Thursday at PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com.